So, hi, this is Jonathan Cloud and Victoria Zellin, and this is officially podcast number one, episode number one in our seminar series, our podcast series.
There was a zero before that.
Yes, that was the one in which we were trying out the technology, trying to see what we needed to do to make it work. But this is really the beginning.
Zero serves as a very good overview of where we're coming from.
That's true. We may go back and get some of that material.
Absolutely.
Right. But this phrase, the beginning of everything, started as a kind of ironic phrase to refer to the insight that we had that started us on recording the podcast series, for me anyway. So it's what had us start to spill the beans, as it were. But of course, it also refers to the origin of the cosmos, and whatever we know about that, which is eventually what we want to get to in this first episode. And there is a place
what
that we're
about
going
the cosmos?
To. Well, we want to work our way back to, you know, what this is all about.
Right.
Right. So, so let's start exactly where this started, which for me was with the idea of dying. I've been thinking about this quite a bit lately, partly because I'm now 71, mm-hmm. and partly because my tests show that I might have prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. Makes you think about your own mortality, which in turn makes you think about what it is you still want to accomplish. Because the curious thing about death is that thinking about it really focuses you on living and not on death and dying so much. I mean, you still have to think about those things, but really it's about what are you going to do with your life, not anything else, right? So in my case, it started me thinking about what I still wanted to contribute, because the fact is it's really not about what you want to have so much as what you want, what you have to give before you die. And when I thought about that, it became pretty clear that I needed to get some ideas out or on paper or spoken out loud for the benefit of anyone who might be interested in hearing them. So here's some of what I wrote down. That's, you know, I want to read a couple of these little things.
But that's really, really cool, is that I don't think people get that when you're dying, what you think about is, when you see your mortality, that what you think about is, oh my gosh, I don't have that much time to give what I want to give, not right. Get what I want to get.
Right.
Because, I mean, get it so that you can die?
Right.
No, you're going to die. So what would you rather be doing, acquiring or giving?
Right.
And I think when people are on their deathbed, that's what they, you know, they wonder if they gave enough.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Or if they were even conscious of giving, which would be even right. worse. Right.
So here's what I wrote down a few days before before my birthday. I've been thinking a lot about death lately, partly because I'm turning 71 in a couple of days and partly because of a tentative diagnosis of prostate cancer. Death is all around us. It's easy to hear about it and the way it affects other people. But thinking and hearing about one's own death is more difficult. It's not that I have any objection in principle. It's that I'm not sure whether I've lived my life fully enough to be willing to say goodbye to it yet. Mm-hmm. I'm aware, for example, that I'm leaving a pile of notes and papers behind, most of which is of no interest whatsoever to anyone, and precious little of it that I do think could make a difference. I haven't yet found a way to pull it all together, from my own story to our latest insights into the nature of reality and of our existence on this planet. Whatever I've said so far has been at best partial and incomplete, so I now want to say it all over again. But then I'd have to stop whatever I'm doing now and do nothing but write until the end of my time here. And the reality is that I'm in the middle of many things. Pace, the eco-village, refinancing the house, getting a second opinion on my prostate, MRI, and planning new ventures, most of which depend to some significant degree on my involvement. So the compromise is to keep doing them and steal time out once in a while, a Friday afternoon in this case, to make some notes about what's important, right? So this is kind of how I see us operating, is that we're living a full life and, you know, you have to take time out to reflect and also to articulate and to share and to explain what it is that we're doing and seeing and what it is that we have to contribute. So this is really where I wanted to start from. And if...
Say it again and concisely.
So
what is it that...
Well, so if you get clear about what it is that you still need to do before you die, that's what you should be focusing on. And so I thought to myself, well, so if I were, if this were really true, if this prostate thing really does turn out to be cancerous and it's rampant and, you know, the whole thing is coming to an end.
Right, yeah.
In short order, what things would I absolutely want to have done? And those things are to articulate these topics that we're talking about. And leave some record of everything that I have thought about them, you know, or at least the conclusions that I've reached at this point.
That's great.
So
I'm all for that.
Right.
And so I started, as long as you let me put my ideas in.
Yeah, absolutely. And, and I request that you get closer to the microphone when you speak. And okay.
Great. Absolutely. Just wanted to be clear that we're in equal.
We are, absolutely.
Equal contribution to this podcast.
Right, absolutely. So when I went looking on the internet, I had this idea that, you know, it should be notes on dying. And so I went looking on the internet because I'm sure somebody else had written a whole bunch of stuff about that. And in fact, I found a website called Notes on Dying, part of a series of reflections on talks by Michael Stone at the Center of Gravity, a nomadic yoga Buddhist joint in Toronto. So this is somebody else's reflections coming from a Zen perspective. So from this site, one of the things I got was this idea of value history, which is designed to let your family and friends know how you feel. And he has a series of questions that he suggests we all of us ask ourselves. Now, this is particularly in the context of thinking about mortality or thinking about dying. But really, it makes sense as a way of sharing who you are with everyone about everything, right? So, perfect introduction to this podcast series.
I mean, you have to go, please.
Let me take it where we actually, you know, look at some of these questions. Take a moment and think about some of the things you've accomplished in your life.
This is
This is from Mike Hulboom.
Okay.
And take a moment and think about some of the things in your life you've accomplished in your life and what you still want to accomplish. So, you know, you use this as a way to think about.
Wow, this is amazing.
Right.
What great questions.
And then, what is it that makes you, you? Consider how you would like to die. Do you see yourself in a hospital, at home, or someplace else? Is your death sudden or lingering? Why is it important to you that it is sudden or lingering? Who do you want present with you in your dying? Who do you not want present with you in your dying? Are there things you want to make clear to other people? Give examples, e.g., do you want flowers in the room, an altar? Do you want someone to touch you? Do you want not to be touched? Do you have a bottom line in terms of what you would physically or mentally need in order for your life to still have meaning? E.g., would your life still have meaning if you couldn't communicate? And finally, what's your greatest fear about dying? So, these are questions that you know, we can all ask ourselves, and it begins to say who we are as a complete human being, right? At least at this stage in our lives, when we contemplate that this could, you know, it could end at any time. And what you have to contribute is just really what you see and experience. As a human being, you have to articulate it so that other people can share it.
Hmm.
Right? So, so what I want to key on, what comes up when I think of what's unfinished or is there, when I turn my mind in this direction, all there is, says Swillbum, is bringing our heart's generosity to every situation. It's to discover what more we have to give. That's really what I'm doing here. So what that led me to was the realization that I had to lay out certain things. One of them was the idea for the alternative currency, for commons credits, for the contribution economy, and for the commons credit exchange concept. And so that's going to be in the next podcast in this series. But this really gives you kind of the overview. The second thing was to have, you know, an episode that was about how we see making the world work, because we've spent a lot of time thinking about that and thinking about win-win business models that work to make the world work. And I think we can really spell that out in considerable detail. Thirdly, the contribution economy, which is the idea of what we value, placing a value on what we value. Fourth, the global brain, global mind / global mind concept, which is really about our collective consciousness as a species. Number five is our thoughts on Earth system governance. And number six is our personal story and how we're learning to surrender to each other's wants and needs. And, you know, I think that's the key to merit of bliss. you know, I don't know if we're going to be able to get away with doing all of this and people still be left with, this is really the key to being in love, being happy together, you know,
what?
Being enlightened.
Enlightened can bring people together.
Right.
When you realize what's important and where things are and what we need to do about it. And
right.
It doesn't hurt to have a ton of landmark education training.
Absolutely.
In your striving for that. I don't know how anyone can do it otherwise, but
right.
Each to his own. Do it the hard way or do it the easy way.
I'd
like to do it the easy way.
Yes.
Landmark made it easy.
Right. And I think that we could actually do an episode on Landmark at some point, mm-hmm. maybe outside of the series. But and because I think there's going to be more after this. This is really just a kind of first series of podcasts.
No. If we're going to be authentic about it, it's just we've picked moments that make sense to suggest this is where we got this and we recommend doing this.
Sure.
And then we just do that whenever it occurs to us. And we give people the tools to get there. But we also could do one session on it
right.
in the context of what we're up to. That would be really great. But I would do it as a session. I'm not going to do it something off the set. It's all about transformation. And there's so many kinds of transformation. Mm-hmm. Wardrobe transformation.
Right.
Communication and human being transformation. Transformation in business model thinking mm-hmm. and in keeping money local, in eating, you know, in harmony mm-hmm. With all the things that, you know, are useful to think about. I mean, all these things are levels of the systems thinking that converge in what an eco-village is
mm-hmm.
and a sustainable, regenerative community, which of course, we would want all communities to be in the face of climate change. And so
right.
that's where I came up with the mission to revise our mission statement for CRCS, to have it be the Center for resilient community or resilient community solutions. I mean, regenerative is just a little step too far, because most people in the area of sustainability, it's about mitigate, like reduce carbon, adapt, deal with the impacts of climate change and fossil fuel and all that, and kind of prepare and adapt. Three is become resilient, is that you can deal with anything you've got after you adapt it, right? Because you had to adapt in order to become resilient. Once you're resilient and in a 360 way in every aspect, then you can start regenerating. So resilient is kind of like a force against, you know, like defending, whereas regenerating is a very positive thing. So I think people really need to go through that cycle with regard to climate change. You know, some people may jump on in adaptation, but, you know, you got to do mitigation too, because it's all about cutting carbon. You can't really, I mean, people who are into this, they're going to do mitigation and they're going to do adaptation and they're going to do resiliency. And some of them are going to do regeneration. But that is true in, you know, probably all aspects of life, is that we have that, you know, do less of something bad, you know, adapt, you know, realize that you're actually very strong. You're strong enough to handle all the things that you were afraid of before. And then you turn around and you say, okay, what's next? Like, how do I regenerate? How do I keep this flourishing state alive? And then I have to regenerate because conditions change. And I think that's a really nice model. And it could get perfected. But I think it could be on our website, make it real simple. You know, and the CRCS, it would be helping communities to mitigate, adapt, become resilient, and regenerate in the face of climate change. And there's those are the stages, you know, to take people through. And you kind of have to do the precursors before you do, you know, like it's cumulative. You can't jump without having taken care of the others. So, you know, we can help communities, you know, do that kind of thing and see it as a regenerative community solution, that they're going to work through all those stages, because trying to jump to one without having also done the others are kind of hypocritical. You have to have reduced your impact, and you have to have, you know, mitigated your risks, right? Until you're ready to start thinking about regeneration, you know, you mitigate your risks and you know you've got, you've handled the big risks. Now, how do we regenerate this? How do we actually grow further? It's kind of like,
well, except that, you know, in some ways, it's a real shift in perspective to think about the world from a regenerative perspective, as opposed to from a sustainable or resiliency perspective.
Yes, exactly.
And it's partly that shift in perspective and in paradigm that I think is important in terms of what allows people to see the world more the way that we see it, where we're coming from.
It is regenerative. Yeah, we can't go, we can't say it's the, but if Gus wants to call it that, it's part of the equation. Yeah, he just doesn't get regenerativity that much.
Well,
he's cynical.
But I don't know. I think you kind of made that up, because you suggested that to him, that, that, you know, you changed the name to resilient.
And he said, I agree with you.
Oh, but I mean, you just created that. He had no idea.
All right. So he didn't fight back. He didn't say, no, we're really regenerative.
Well, I'm fighting back because I know that we're really more than that.
We are. We really are. We have to hold out something bigger and better. Resilient is such a negative word, if you ask me.
Well, so is sustainable. How's your
absolutely?
How's your relationship? Well, it's sustainable. You know, I'm managing to get through this. No. That's not the relationship we want. The relationship we want is the one
regenerative.
We have.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So in any case, so this is where I really want to start, is with the insights that you and I keep having mm-hmm. about how to create a world that works. And that's mm-hmm. what we keep coming back to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, arguably, we could start anywhere mm-hmm. to talk about that. But I think the place that we have to start is with economics. Mm-hmm. Because it's important, because a lot of the reason we have a world that doesn't work has to do with the way we think about value and about money. Right. And to understand that, in turn, we need to consider the whole of human history, how we emerge from the caveman right up to what we call modern civilization. And I put quotes around that phrase, modern civilization, because I mean it only as a description, not some sort of approval. We still have, in my opinion, a long way to go. But the reality is also that it's an extraordinary accomplishment, and one that makes possible the sort of global prosperity Buckminster Fuller suggested in Utopia or Oblivion. So what I'm really trying to say there is, you know, this what we call the capitalist system, and which I would prefer to call the free enterprise system, mm-hmm. you know, and I think there's a real difference between those two. But this has produced this enormous amount of material wealth, food to feed a world of 8 billion, 9 billion, 10 billion people. All the technology we have, all the infrastructure that we have, all this stuff has gotten created through this economic system. So it's not all bad. It's just, it's gotten to a point where it has to shift, because the direction in which it's going is not sustainable within the framework.
And I think, I really actually think that one of the reasons that people will want to have what we're talking about as a global governance system succeed, because they are operating in countries that don't allow them to do what they know should be done and what they could do. So their national borders and their leadership are, for the most part, squelching the things that need to get done. Mm-hmm. And so if there's a hope that there could be a more benevolent global citizenry that will really understand what's the right thing to do, and not this ridiculous politics that every nation has that totally mm-hmm. stifles its creativity and its value, and, you know, all the stupid cultural things that keep things the way they are versus allowing change. Every culture has them. And in this global citizenry, we'll, you know, have compassion for those idiocies, and we'll coach each other mm-hmm. to see how we might do it if we were intelligent beings and not wrapped up in our own cultural ideologies and politics. Is that they would look at the situation and they say, well, a sane person would vote for this. And everybody would look and they'd go, yeah, that makes sense. But we have so much invested in making it wrong. But, you know, that person would be able to see, you know, what is really implementable given the America that there is. I mean, they wouldn't be doing some theoretical answer. They'd be doing, given what you've got, here is a way to make it work politically. But the politics follow the values and the behaviors and all that kind of stuff. So it just ends up as one label or another. You just have to unpack those two labels and you find all the different variations on a theme inside of those two parties. I mean, taking all Americans and saying they have to be black or white, you know, most of us are pretty gray, you know. And so what kind of gray are you? So I think people, if they saw the possibility of a global governance that actually could work with practically, you know, and that you actually had a plan to make it work, given, you know, the volunteerism, people go, yeah, you know, like that's possible. You know, you shoot for the moon, and if you reach a star, or you shoot for a star and you reach a moon, yeah, that's pretty good. It's better than you would have done before.
Right.
Right?
Right. So here's what I'm saying about this, and I think what you're saying about this, which is that human beings are intelligent all over the world. Mm. And they all see the limitations of their own culture at some level, as well as the limitations of other cultures. And it's by referring to ourselves as the global citizens that we are, or as the inhabitants of this spaceship, Earth, that we are, the crew and the passengers on spaceship Earth, that we can begin to see ourselves in that context. That's who we are, right?
Right.
And as being that, we are thinking at a level that's already above the national interests and the ethnic interests and the particularities.
Well, we're looking at what kind of a structure could accommodate all of those different views.
Right.
To have an allegiance to something bigger than themselves, even if it's like the UN, but it's different than the UN.
Well, or at least to balance each other out in such a way as to maintain the integrity of the planet, as opposed to fighting with each other and competing and harming the fabric of life on the planet. Because, I mean, let's face it, most of the things that are going on in the world today are a bit of a mess.
Well, you know, it would be interesting if you had a parallel organization to the UN and the COP, you know, 21. And the parallel organization was practical people in each of those countries who are tied into those negotiations, but who could look at together with the others in a group. And it could be a subset of that larger group, or it could be a whole other group, and say, what would be a global solution? You know, what would you get from you, and what would you have to give, and what would you have to get? And we got it all together, and then we give it to this COP 22.
Well, and there is something like that going on.
There is?
Because alongside the official negotiations are all the people's organizations that get involved in
this. But are they organized into another organization?
You know, I haven't read a lot about it, but I'm going to go looking for it now.
Because if they're all fighting for their own interests, it's just more the same.
Well, it's not. No. The idea is that the, you know, young people of Bolivia and the young people of the U.S. all, you know, go to these climate negotiations
they,
and put forward their own ideas in talking about...
But that's not a model that's sustainable. Here's what a model that would be sustainable is to have a shadow organization, and that shadow organization would look at the organizational dynamics, they'd look at the world's resources, they'd look at who's pledging what and what do they have to back it up, and what hasn't this guy done, and, you know, just makes a proposal for here's what is equitable. You know, and we've looked at all the resources and all the psychologies behind these different relationships, and this is what we think is doable, and this is what we recommend that you adopt. And then the negotiations can go on with the people in power to say, are we willing to do this? You're absolutely right, you know, because you really want to vet that this is what's going on, and this is a solution that could work. If everybody played their part, it could work. Mm-hmm. It seemed to, you know, the United States unfair because we seem to be, you know, having to do more than others, but we've already done more than others and we can do more than others, but it's not dependent on us. It's every country doing everything it could do inside of the political reality that doesn't have some kind of blue sky. People's political realities are going to change. They're not. Would be, you know, I hope there are people who are trying to work together and create solutions, given everything that's known. I mean, otherwise, if you're trying to negotiate, then...
Well, this raises the question as to whether there is...
Is there a plan?
...an effort to create an assembly of global citizens.
Right. And, that's what I've been saying for a really long time.
Right. So,
and to have create some kind of structure,
right?
What is the who's talking about global governance and what are they saying?
You know, people worry about it because it sounds like it's a way to usurp power, But really, it's a way to
there is no power until it
knowledge.
Is. Yes, there is no right. power in this thing until people grant it power. And the power yeah. we'd like it to grant, we will brand and shape in a very non-controversial way to say, you know, we think that if the right people got together in global governance, we could help feed the official national bodies and these NATOs and this with the best intelligence on what, if they were to do and the others would do, it would all work out because somebody understands all the resources and all the constraints mm-hmm. and they're analyzing all those things from an internal political and a group dynamics and, you know, all of those different
right.
things. And, you know, you'd think that, you know, see, that would be something that the people would want to fund. They'd want to fund, you know, having people think about the global resources and what's workable to get things done and to create a plan
right.
and to do it with minimal resources because all you're doing is getting on the right side of the group that's fighting for what's right
mm-hmm.
and put your weight against them because there's already people doing that because it's the right thing and you, people are smart. There's going to be some people doing the right thing and you support people doing the right thing.
Absolutely.
And just giving them our... you know, acknowledgement that this group is doing the right thing by our analysis. Take us to task, if you will, but this looks like the right thing for the world. And if we get this governing body to actually be credible in calling things, calling the shots on things and having people say that's very courageous, that's actually right, and it brings to the fore things that, you know, have been hidden about the global economy, and this is what could happen a lot, as long as these people do this and you shame people into doing it and, you know, it kind of works.
Well, and all that has to be, you know, laid out. It has to be part of the official and understood communication system and all that relates
is that to... Is that a little bit big?
No, but it relates to the topics that we're getting to in the rest of the series, which is Earth systems governance
absolutely.
On the one hand. And the global brain on the other, which is both of these are the tools through which we need to talk about this. So I think it's important to remember what our purpose is, which is to lay out some criteria for a world that works, to put some substance on that phrase and to think about ways of getting there. The whole statement is made by Bucky makes me a little uncomfortable. A world that works for everyone with no one and nothing left out. In a literal sense, this is not at any given moment likely to be possible, but in a moral sense, it's a simple concept. We need to think about the well-being and about the well-doing of everything and everyone at the same time. This is one way of talking about the common good, the global commons, the integrity of the living system of the earth that we all belong to. And you know, I really have that strong, powerful sense after reading James Lovelock's thing about Gaia. You know, at one level, it's a very simple concept. Again, this hypothesis that the Earth itself is a kind of living being. And eventually he, you know, wants to get away from the sort of suggestion that it's a singular organism, but that it's a living system. And that's a much more... you know, acceptable way to talk about it. At the same time, if you think about who we are as a planet, surrounded by this thin atmosphere and traveling through space at, you know, 400,000 miles an hour through the middle of the galaxy, we're already way out there in a spaceship that's built for us. It's designed to support
our life. You know, what's interesting is that all we need is one potential meteor strike that could be as big as, you know, what wiped out the dinosaurs.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, we're going to say, why don't we have a world government?
Right.
We need a world government in a situation like this.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, what are we going, what resources can all the planets put against steering that meteor off course?
Right.
It's going to take money, and the United States can't do it all. And we're all in this together. And so, you know, of course, NATO and all the, you know, the UN and all that, but, you know, would probably take this up, but it would take forever. You know, it would not happen. Well, sometimes things happen quickly there too. And, you know, that could work. That could work. But this shadow government would be actually feeding the UN with what it's going to take and how it's going to work, because that's the organization in power right now to
right. I think
make
that
decisions.
We don't need to necessarily overthrow the institutions. We just need to make them work properly.
Kind of consultation. We could do
right.
free consultation.
Right.
And that's what our organization is going to support, is free consultation to all of these organizations.
Right.
When we
to
have
help
something.
Them,
when we
to
have
help
something.
Help them understand what the, you know,
but
how
it wouldn't
to deal
be
with
you and I. It
system.
Would be
oh,
whatever
course.
The global governance turns out to be and
of
the
course.
Leadership that's elected by the global governance.
Right.
Which is probably not us, and I hope not. I don't really want to
well,
leave the world.
Well, no, I mean, but again, we're articulating what's possible here.
Oh, absolutely.
And,
yeah,
and
yeah.
If others understand the questions that we're asking and the ideas that we're
suggesting. I'd say the twists. We can nominate the twists to run the world.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
But again, you got to get closer and keep speaking into
okay.
the mic here.
Lynn Twist and Bill Twist, yeah.
So we have to start by asking the right questions, which have to do with where we want to get to. What do we mean by a world that works? Is it one that's at war with itself, that is eating itself out from the inside, that's spewing carbon into the air and running a fever? This is a global pattern that is unsustainable and is already changing as we continue to discharge a disproportionate amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We destabilize the dynamic equilibrium that the rest of nature works to maintain. It's important to remember that life has been maintaining the present composition of the atmosphere for hundreds of millions of years, allowing us to travel billions of miles through outer space aboard a very remarkable spaceship Earth. Think of it, the planet itself is an integrated living system that sustains all life, mainly within a few feet of its physical surface, maintaining an external atmosphere while hurtling through space, rotating around a sun that is itself traveling at 450,000 miles per hour through the Milky Way galaxy. We can't exist outside of this environment. We're part of it, and it's part of us. If we want to leave the Earth for brief excursions to Mars or the Moon, we have to take part of that environment with us in order to survive. You know, so we and the environment are one. We and the planet are one. We just don't get it. We think, I don't know what we think, but if people are running around killing each other, they don't see that we and the planet are one. So the planet itself will be fine. It's just that at some point, the atmosphere and the environment may become toxic to us as a species. This is nature's way of terminating experimental forms of life that don't work out and of moving on to try something else. We know that something like 99% of all the species that have ever existed are extinct, and that we're currently witnessing the sixth mass extinction event since the beginning of life in the oceans. We're still at an early stage, but the changes we're making to the climate could trigger catastrophic die-offs in whole sections of the food and life chains we depend on. The planet itself will continue. It just may look more like Mars or Venus than it does today, and harbor a very different form of life, if any at all. What this means is that you and I need to do something about changing the behavior of humans everywhere. We need to teach and to practice not just living more lightly on the Earth, but actively tending to it, helping it regenerate. This kind of change is already happening. It's what we're committed to doing at Andover Eco Village, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of other projects like it emerging everywhere, supported by millions of people who are becoming more ecologically self-aware. Now we need to communicate this to everyone else, stop the fighting, reverse the course of carbon pollution, and restore the Earth's capacity to restore itself. So this is where the alternative currency comes in, because we need an economy that produces this outcome, not one that hinders it. We need to complement the impacts of the economic system we call capitalism with an economics of regeneration, of regenerating the resources that capitalism depends on by making our own processes more like those of the rest of nature. So, you know, there we've talked about kind of biomimicry and the importance of, you know, operating like nature, and also, you know, the central concept of regeneration as a complement to all the destruction that's going on. You know, that the laissez-faire capitalist system has given rise to. And so that's really the essence of what I wanted to get across in our first episode of these podcast series. Now, I don't know that we really got to the origins of the cosmos.
Oh, no. I mean, but we can talk about that another time.
But we got to the origins of why we're doing this and what's important about all this stuff and how we see unfolding it. Right?
Want to summarize in a thumbnail what you just meant?
Well, that if you look at us as a part of the living system that is Gaia, or mm-hmm. the Earth, playing our role in it, we have to take kind of responsibility for making it a healthy place. Like the brain in a human takes responsibility for keeping the body healthy, or you know, all of the good germs that are inside us that are helping to clean out our, digest our food and clean our intestines and keep our blood flowing. And all those kinds of things are the positive life force that's pushing against the disintegrative force of, thermodynamics, that things tend to run down. Naturally, they tend to disintegrate, dissolve, go into an equilibrium state, just kind of, which really is a form of death in a way. And so life is struggling against that, growing against that. That's what we're talking about doing at a global level, and bringing humans to that point where they see themselves as living that way. And this gives rise to the possibility of a new economy, to the possibility of a new way of life, and to a new world civilization, if you like, a new level of evolution on the part of human beings on the planet.
In the face of climate change.
Right, and all the other catastrophes that mm-hmm. are coming together mm-hmm. to yes. force us to change
yes.
as yeah. a species. Great. So I want to thank everyone.
And
there we put the, we bring this to a close and put a name on it mm-hmm. and be able to see if we can, put it together and put it on the web. And
sure. What's the name? What is the name already?
So this is, the whole series is The World That Works, mm-hmm. Or Building a World That Works. And this particular episode, which is episode number one, is, you know, where it all starts.
Could mean anything.
Could mean virtually anything. But it's where we start
okay.
from.
Yeah.
Which is this relationship to the planet.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Great.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.